Occasional Prayer. The essay begins with an epigraph from Khalil Gibran. You pray in your distress and in your need. Would that you might also pray in the fullness of your joy and in your days of abundance. She asks for quiet. I merge the car onto the tollway, balancing a cup of McDonald's coffee between my legs. Our little ritual. We'll place the cups in their cardboard tray, and during the first mile or so, each say a quiet prayer for safety, for ours and others. Mine will be a simple request, a statement, really. Please watch over us and see that we arrive safely from our destination to our destination. Please watch over all drivers and pedestrians and see that each and every one arrives safely from their destination to their destination. In my best cultural Catholicism, this will be followed by a mumbled Lord's Prayer. I'll labor to concentrate while I pray, elbowing out pesky grammarian voices. Amy always takes a little longer, gazing at passing fields. Her Jewish entreaties are longer and more involved. Complex, anyway. I have more people to say hi to, she'll shrug later. Before long, I'm eyeing my coffee, idly thinking I'll check Wikipedia when we get back home and read up on those coffee-burning lawsuits. Real? Urban myth? Anyway, I'm impatient to drink. The routine and self-centeredness that quickly wove itself into praying when I was young is a fact of my spiritual life that I've often wondered about, sensing that it must mean something, suggest a larger understanding of the worthiness of a life lived in conscious struggle. When I fell away from the church in my late teens, I fell as a cliché. Burdened at an early age with hyper-self-consciousness, I'd be overly aware while at Mass at St. Andrew the Apostle, gripped in the classic adolescent manner by doubts and anxieties. Am I getting it? What it was, I didn't know, only that the stern frowns of the nuns that I imagined turned toward me while I struggled to focus on prayer felt like the facial equivalent of a check minus. When I was 10 or 11 years old, I was convinced that my family was trying to kill me. Each night I'd lean over the bathroom sink down the hall from the bedroom I shared with my younger brother, trembling as I brushed my teeth, knowing for certain, the certainty being the splash of cold fear in my chest, that my older brothers, conniving with my parents, had poisoned the crest with venom hidden in the basement. I'd lie in bed later next to my younger brother and stare at the dark ceiling in slow, crawling dread that I'd within minutes begin the agonizing writhe into death. My siblings' jackal, wild-eyed faces hovered over me in the dark. I'd hear conspiratorial muttering in the hallway, quiet smiling. Eventually, my fears blossomed to include poisoned breakfasts, lunches, dinners, snacks, all manner of household terror cuisine. A couple of years later, I was locked in chest-tightening blues in seventh grade, convinced that my friends hated me and wanted me to disappear. In my imagination, I was plagued by boys who yapped at each other in a foreign language and with girls with blossoming breasts who looked right through me. I'd wander to the other side of St. Andrews and stand mutely and pathetically by a pole and its flopping flag. I confessed this all to my mom on a long night when she found me sobbing hysterically in the shower, Fabergé organic shampoo running down my face. Moments later, she slapped me. It's testament to the relationship I have with my mom that I understood the desperation behind the gesture. Her son was turning into a self-obsessed monster. Get out of yourself already. I had a small bruise to lie about the next day, though I don't think anyone noticed. Within a couple of weeks, the depression lifted. I was social again. I never confessed to my family my irrational fears that they were trying to dispose of me. Instead, I prayed. Staring into darkness, I'd clasp my hands and mutter pleas to the ceiling. By morning, waking bittersweetly to the chirpings of blackbirds and the roar of a ride-on bus outside my window, the fear was gone, but the memory would wash over me, leaving a faint ink stain. Of course, soon enough, this paranoia lifted for good, replaced by another comic opera, courtesy of puberty. But I'm not so sure that I'll ever understand. My response to a fundamental dread was to reach for words that might somehow haul me above the lousy bedroom and my own manufactured dread. I returned to praying fervently when I was in college. I'd met my girlfriend Janet the summer after high school. We both had worked at Baskin-Robbins, forging a kind of acne-scarred bunker mentality, our wrists heroically weary, arms tattooed in chocolate almond and daiquiri ice. Looking back at the relationship unraveling painfully over the next several years, I wonder why I didn't end it sooner. Most of the hysteria was the age-appropriate melodrama particular to liberal arts majors convinced that they discovered the irony of thrift store clothes shopping, and who spent hours on the phone lamenting the distance and the failure of language to translate the exquisite experience of being in love, etc. I learned the word egocentric from my mom, who'd mutter it under her breath while passing by me, curled up on a chair near the phone, receiver in hand, as she calculated extravagant phone bills. Now, I see a 19-year-old kid in over his head, flirting with girls in his romantic lit class, comparing his girlfriend's butt and thighs to theirs, longing for a hickey and a secret smile from a new girl. Janet and I became too involved too soon, and I had too big a heart, or too puny the courage, to break up with her and to get drunk with new girls, snug in tight jeans and leg warmers in the loud, sticky bars along Route 1 in College Park. Even if I silently deplored the fashion choices of the girls I sat next to, I was too ironic for anything but thrift shop chic. I longed to lie in a couch with them and unbutton their Calvin Klein off-the-rack color block blouses and tug down their acid-washed, casually torn guest jeans. After college, I moved away to Southeast Ohio to begin graduate school. I was untethered from Janet and our mutual friends and began my semi-dedicated career as a drinker and serial womanizer, knowing that even lost in rum hangovers sweetened by patchouli oil, kiss-sore lips, and a new bright-eyed girl's bra and panties under my bed, Janet's heart was a large and generous, if frightfully naive and kind heart that really, really didn't deserve this. I stayed with her and carried inside of my chest a nervous chill that lasted for years. I had dreams wherein I pleaded to surgeons with shadows for faces to cut open the front of me and remove this pulpy mass of nerves, which I visualized as a kind of cancerous lump. I was clearly depressed, not only in the existential way that so many 20-somethings are, burdened by a future grimly promising that the value and currency of pure sensation and of matters of the heart will diminish in the face of pricey, looming adulthood. I was twisted by the growing unhappiness with my girlfriend, wrestling with a somewhat absurd, gallant notion of doing the right thing and staying with her. She of such great promise, only the year before. One windy fall day, I was moving across campus between classes, or more likely, during classes. I looked up from my self-centered stupor. There, the fresh, blinding white of Memorial Chapel. I entered into the calm and the quiet, two states of being foreign to me in college, and the clean, bracing, woodsy smell of pew and altar that brought me back to childhood. Leaving bright sunshine, the politics of the classroom and cafeteria, the swell of humanity behind me, I discovered in the chapel a cool silence that compelled me to face a couple of things, though I wasn't articulating this to myself with clarity at age 20. One, quiet contemplation and prayer forces you to engage yourself, to self-interrogate. Two, God am I self-absorbed. Invariably, my prayers revolve around one entity, the most all-encompassing being in the universe. So I took to praying. The odd Sunday, alone or with family, that I'd begun to again attend Mass became, well, a religious experience. The period I looked forward to the most during services was after Eucharist, when I'd return to the pew and kneel in silence, press my hands together so tight that they'd whiten, and focus so intensely on saying the Lord's Prayer that I felt as if I'd become invisible to myself, my chief and most fervent wish ever since adolescence. Next to me, my bored brother would turn and make some sarcastic crack, our usual sacramental pastime, but then notice my eyes shut tight, my brow furrowed, my lips moving. He'd back off, curious and annoyed with me that I'd embarrassed him for intruding, for sabotaging our churchly gossiping. I was curious, too, about this newfound capacity to leave behind daily dread by focusing on prayer, or more accurately, on the pleasure of words, on the satisfying sibilance slithering around my mouth. I thought that I understood meditation in these moments, the elemental release of all things material, the phrase, lead us not into temptation, becoming a mantra for me and an especially meaningful one, as a kind of chanted talisman to ward off not only sexual holds, but, I realize now, the temptation to surrender to myself and to myself's obnoxious, noxious indulgences. I was addicted to Joe, and the temptations were too great. My occasional prayer finds me less reaching a higher state than desperately shedding ego. Perhaps this explains my impulse to write autobiographically. Does self-addiction wriggle from its straitjacket by turning outward to others in an attempt to make larger, humane sense? And I wonder, can I pray for that? Prayer does not change God, writes Kierkegaard, but changes him who prays. One clammy, bug-drenched night, I staggered out of my house into the early dark, pointed surely if aimlessly down the street. Within a block, I knew what I wanted, to pray and to leave myself behind. I headed toward Georgia Avenue, the main busy thoroughfare through Wheaton, and turned south toward Holy Cross Hospital. 2.5 miles later, I arrived, damp, knifed into the air-conditioned coolness of the hospital lobby, and made a quick right toward the chapel. I was customarily pleased to learn that the chapel door was open, is always open, and I took a seat in the middle pew. I took note of the two other people there, an anonymous supplicant, a mother perhaps praying for a child or another loved one, and a nun, always a nun, bobbing her head in sacred solitude. There's great, if unusual, comfort in praying in a chapel at the very hospital where one had been born decades before, somewhere upstairs. The utter care into which I'd been delivered, the weight of the years behind me, these sensations were intensified as, catching my breath, I settled into the growing serenity of public prayer. Most appealing, indeed at the time what was necessary for me, was the buoyancy, as if shutting eyes tight and clasping hands together acted as a kind of sealant, trapping inside of me a consecrated lightlessness, a vapor that would slowly lift me from myself. Beyond this, the sad counterweight of my body, that sweating thing, tethered to the ground where girlfriends, flirtatious eyes, and other major nuisances prowled. If I'd opened my eyes or unclasped my hands, the helium would release, and down to the world I'd go. Christ encourages private prayer. From Matthew 6, quote, "But when you pray, go into your room, close the door, and pray to your Father who is unseen. Then your Father, who sees what is done in secret, will reward you. And when you pray, do not keep on babbling like pagans, for they think they will be heard because of their many words." Quote, "The mind is a large house with many rooms. The rooms are connected by hallways, by frayed runners, by wall lamps, by desire, and by memories. One can seal off a room. A child has moved to college, say, or a mother has expired in the back, or mites have infested the front. But that room remains, a tattoo on those who live and have lived there, indelible. And guests enter the house through the grand rooms, not through the dank basement, the newspaper-strewn back porch, or descending from a musty attic. Yet those ignored rooms remain there, dark, and tissued to other rooms. The mind is a large house with many rooms. We box up and store away what embarrasses and confounds us. Our boxes of pornography, our caches of candy bars, our booze, our rubber-banded letters from ex-boyfriends, ex-girlfriends, lost sons and daughters. Boxes remain, and rooms remain, and we remain in those rooms, though we wished the rooms away. I don't think this is what Christ intends when he calls Apostle Peter to be the rock foundation on which he should build the church, to construct on that rock a large house with many rooms, because into a room of my choice I can safely store prayer away in a box that I hurry to or that I ignore. Can praying be compartmentalized and stacked next to the battleship board game I blow dust off when I'm feeling nostalgic? And yet, too often it is easy to simply close the door behind me after praying, the thrown light switch a darkened synapse gap that widens, stranding me further from prayer as a daily necessity, a daily faith. Muttering in a dark room and then blinking into a front foyer's light, am I really in the same house? Here's Auden, a convert to Christianity, a man with sin in his DNA. Quote, "To pray is to pay attention to something or someone other than oneself. Whenever a man so concentrates his attention on a landscape, a poem, a geometrical problem, an idol, or the true God, that he completely forgets his own ego and desires, he is praying." Quote, "My incessant mental taps on my own shoulder drew attention away from friends, family, work, and toward myself and the growing universe at which I was the center, the ends of my fingertips resting at the furthest incomprehensible cosmos. But I was tired of being my own God." Gandhi writes that, quote, "Prayer is not asking. It is a longing of the soul. It is a daily admission of one's weakness. Quote, okay, I was longing to be rid of myself, admitting to the weakness that was my own in media res biography. I was young, my brain was still developing, I write, to let myself off easy. But I'm displeased with these particular urges to prayer. The origin of most of the appeals I've muttered in my life has been either compulsory or egotistical, catechism or bonomo. This is the trait of the deeply egocentric man. If I long while praying in the Gandhi manner, it's usually a longing for a kind of anonymity, a draining of the nasty details of my personality. I can't ignore the fundamental selfishness there, too, that what I often pray for is a release of my own pettiness, shallowness, immaturity, prayer as self-help. What do I, a man with nearly 5 decades behind him, pray for? The health of my family, the ease of destructive, irrational global politics, but more frequently, that the White Sox will bring the tying runner home from third, that the DVD-R discs will format, that the new stack laundry unit will fit in the pre-existing space. I know, few of us have Gandhi's transcendent will and selflessness. Didn't he lie next to a luscious naked girl one long night of the soul to test his celibacy? Or is that an apocryphal story? In my 17th century lit class, I might have felt Gandhi-like stealing myself next to the girl who I wanted to bend over the desk. But really. Amy and I are back from our drive later, and I'll repeat to myself what she'd said in the car when I'd asked her why her prayers are longer than mine. More people to say hello to. More people to stretch toward on the thin prop of prayer. More to caress in absentia, to tap lovingly on a shoulder, knowing that touch is a foreign language, not spoken here, there. And I'll wonder, who do I have to say hello to? Who do I have to surprise, moist-eyed, my mouth moving oddly, slowly, the other tilting his head tenderly to make out the words? Alone to myself in my room, my words perish on the mirror. In grade school, during required services, the soft rain beyond the stained-glass windows puddling in a grayness at my center that I couldn't comprehend. In adolescence, during Holy Week services with my family, absently running fingers over mountainous acne and recoiling from the sound of my own ugly, monotonous voice. Even now, at a funeral or at a friend's nuptials, praying in muffled tones and shooting side glances at spirit-filled neighbors in the pew, lifting their hearts and souls to the Lord in unself-conscious Hosanna glory. I haven't attended Mass regularly since I was in my late teens, and what's driven me back into church the several odd, if intense, times was the need to run away from myself, that desire itself feeling more and more as the preening of egotism. Only now am I lifting my head and wondering what it is I'm galloping toward. Or asking for.